WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. That's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth,
very
Charlie
good.
Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, welcome to another Monday Night Talk. My name is Kevin Tachi. Joining me in studio is, I want to save some of that applause for my guest co-host, the Mad Dog himself, Maddie Nelson. Matt Nelson in the house this evening as we have a great show. You want to give a rundown of the first hour, Matt?
Sure. We start off with a familiar face, State Rep Allison Sullivan.
Yeah, I have to stop you. It's going to be a familiar voice this evening. She'll be calling in.
Familiar voice.
She'll be calling in. We had an abbreviated conversation last week, and this is more of an extensive conversation in regards to a press conference they had, and this is a non-disclosure agreement legislation that being worked on. State Senator Diane DeSaglio is the original sponsor or the original author of the legislation. She's going to talk a little bit about that.
A lot of people fired up over this bill.
Yes.
There's a lot of excitement that something's finally
being done. Who else do we have?
We've got none other than the U.S. Representative for the 8th Congressional District.
8th Massachusetts.
8th Massachusetts Congressional District, Stephen Lynch.
Very nice. Hour number two.
Hour number two, we've got up-and-coming actor David Cade, who was most recently in Into the Ashes.
Yeah. That's got, there's like a big name attached to it, Frank Grillo. Do you know who Frank Grillo is? How do you remember Frank Grillo? I'll tell you how I remember it. I just want to see how you remember Frank Grillo. Frank Grillo has been in the, he's been an integral part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. As if you remember, one of the Captain Americas, where he was, when you find out that S.H.I.E.L.D. has actually been infiltrated by Hydra.
Spoiler alerts.
The movie's been showing on TBS and TNN. It's okay.
Full disclosure, Kevin.
Oh, you haven't seen these yet?
I have seen, as of last night when I watched Spider-Man Homecoming, I've seen...
Yeah, that was the world premiere, right?
It was.
It was the world premiere, yeah.
On FX, world premiere, uh-huh. On cable.
Yeah.
5 of the 22 relevant Marvel movies.
You get with the times. They're already moving on to Phase 4. All right, so what else do we have? We got special guests. Besides David, we have at 7:30...
Nicole Terry and Shane Lewis, both of the Discovery Channel's Naked and Afraid XL.
It's going to be a good time. Now, what's interesting is is that Shane and Nicole are boyfriend and girlfriend. No, they might be engaged. We'll find out. But interesting enough is Nicole is returning after being on a couple of weeks ago. And so we look forward to chatting with her because this season concluded, I would say, about a week and a half ago. Naked and Afraid XL. It's not the normal Naked and Afraid. And people like, who would go out into some of the harshest terrain on the planet and want to try to survive wearing nothing but, what God gave you. Yeah, a satchel and having maybe a knife and a pan to boil water in. Who would want to do that? We'll learn the fate. So instead of doing it just for 21 days, which is the normal Naked and Afraid, they have Naked and Afraid XL. That's where folks go out for 40 days. And there's even a bigger challenge within that. We'll talk about that coming up at 7:30. But right now, time for us to put our directional on and pull over to the shoulder, if you will. Who is traffic sponsored by?
Traffic this evening sponsored by Brennan's Smoke Shop, online at brennansmokeshopma.com, with locations in Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, and now in Pope's Island, New Bedford, Brennan's Smoke Shop. And bringing us traffic this evening is none other than John Willis. John, what's going on?
Thanks, you guys.
Yeah,
good to see you guys using your blinker, too. This report brought to you by the FCC. Hey, the expressway northbound, we've eased out a bit in the last 10 minutes, but it's still slow up past Furnaceburg Parkway, and you're jammed from Granite Ave up past Neponset Circle. Coming the other way, it's a crawl from the tunnel down to a right-lane crash now after South Bay, and then it jams again after Squantum Street. Route 3 northbound, your stop-and-go Union Street up to the split, 128 southbound, slow passing Route 1. 93 north, slow through Canton, Route 28 up into Braintree. Are some of your local TV channels missing? Find them again by rescanning your TV now. Learn more at fcc.gov/TV rescan. Traffic on the nines every morning. I'm John Willis in the WATD Traffic Center.
Met our friend Dave at this year's Cigar BBQ. Listen, Dave, it's not that I don't like the government. You got me all wrong. It's I don't like a tyrannical government that rips its people off under the pretense of taking care of us, telling us the money is going to be used for something and then using it for something else. Obviously not the MBTA. No, no, no. 18's not an adult. 21 is an adult. Oh, by the way, you can't have that flavor and you can't have that style now that you're a big person. But go ahead, go down the bar and drink all the flavored booze you can and get as clobbered as you want. You want to talk about community impact? They finally fixed 44 down at Plymouth Ragua. It only took 20 years. How's that for community impact? Brennan's Smoke Shop. Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford. Brennan's Smoke Shop. The best smoke shop in Massachusetts because we pay our taxes. Dave.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Hey, we're back for segment in queue, as we are going to speak right now with the state representative, representing the 7th Plymouth District, Allison Sullivan. Allison, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Kevin. How are you?
Now, I'm not alone. I get the mad dog with me, but trust me, he's had all his shots. He's good to go. He's apprised of our conversation this evening, so he will ask pertinent questions, I promise you. Are you there? I think I lost her. Representative?
Can you hear me, Kevin?
Yeah, I can hear you. So for some reason, you came and you went. So we had you briefly on last week at the start of the show, and you and I talked a little bit about the press conference that was held with State Senator Diane DeSaglio to talk about the non-disclosure agreement reform bill. If you can actually remind folks that the idea behind the media event was not only to bring light to the legislation, but it was also to also get the state auditor involved in it as well. Is that correct?
Correct, yes. So we're asking for, the reason why we held the press conference is not only to bring light to Senate Bill 929, which Senator DeSaglio filed this legislation process, but also to ask the state auditor to do somewhat of an audit of each agency in regards to the use of non-disclosure agreements within their practices.
Okay. Do you have a follow-up question, Matt?
I do. So speaking of media events, there was a press release put out by Lori Trahan and Ayanna Pressley's office applauding this effort. They say all politics is local, and is the case here with the big guys in Washington applauding the work of the Massachusetts State House. So what does that add to the weight behind this bill?
So I know that Senator DeSaglio was able to speak, I believe, with both the congressmen. I actually haven't spoken with either one of them, but I believe it brings light to and attention to what we're trying to do here. And it's a very much a bipartisan issue in regards to non-disclosure agreements. We're not trying to get the actual content of those agreements in regards to names. What we're trying to do is bring it to the public's awareness of the use of non-disclosure agreements and the understanding of what non-disclosure agreements are really originally used for. So right now what we're seeing is they're used for any purposes within the state government to the point where we don't even know why or how they're being used, and we don't know if any settlement is attached to them as well. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to bring light to the use of the non-disclosure agreements, which is pretty much a silencing agreement on people within state government and public, but also if there's also settlement, so money attached to that, which pretty much would be covered under the non-disclosure agreement, where that person wouldn't be able to talk about how much their claim was settled for. So I think it's a huge issue, especially when you're talking about taxpayer funds that are being used in these hush agreements.
I think it's worth asking, is this move, is the Senate Bill number 929 strictly for the state government level, or is it other aspects as well?
So the way that she filed it, the senator filed it, it would cover all non-disclosure agreements, including in the public sector. However, our push is more so, at least from my point of view, is that we want to really focus in on the public sector, so taxpayer funds that are used in these hush agreements, these silencing agreements, and the settlements attached to them. So I know that, and I bet both of you are familiar with the process. You know, a bill's filed one way and it comes out of committee and on the floor completely different. So I think our focus is mainly on the use of public funded non-disclosure agreement.
Okay. Matt?
This bill, as I mentioned, is getting a lot of support from, as you mentioned, both sides, bipartisan issue. It's got a number of co-sponsors. Can you talk a little bit about the support that it's received on the state level from different representatives around the Commonwealth?
So I've reached out to some of my colleagues in regards to asking for their support in the whole process, and I'm hoping that once we get it out of committee, and I'm working on the Judiciary Committee itself, because that's who we testified in front of was the Judiciary Committee. But I have had conversations with multiple members within the House of Representatives, and I'm hoping that with those conversations, we will gain the support we need in order to pass this legislation forward. Right now, what our focus is on is getting a report so we can report back to the public about how their taxpayer funds are being used.
So basically put it out there as to how many of these NDAs are out there and who's involved and how much money has been spent.
Right. I mean, there's a report that there's been 33 in the House of Representatives since 2010.
Wow.
However, we don't know what the number is that's attached to that, like as far as settlement. And for whatever reason, they're being used to cover bad practices, bad behaviors. I mean, we don't know what it would be covered because they're just being used so freely.
Is there any desire to go back any further than 2010, or is that just kind of the basis for the report, just so you'll be able to report this?
That's the one we've got for as far as the House of Representatives, that there's been about 33 non-disclosure agreements used since 2010. In the state auditor report, we asked for her to go back 5 fiscal years to start off with, just to get an idea and overview as far as how much funds are being used, how many non-disclosure agreements are being used, and where they're being used. We want to know what branch of government, what agency is more prevalent in using them and why.
As Matt had pointed out, Congresswomen Trahan and Presley, both of them applauding your efforts, the efforts of yourself and Senator DiZoglio. But I also understand that they're also introducing legislation on the federal level. Are you surprised that this is a widespread problem?
No, I mean, I'm not surprised that it's being used across the United States. I think it's something that we should be looking into, especially in the federal government, any type of government. There should be transparency. Transparency is good government. This is a good government policy right here. We're not trying to, put anyone out in a situation where they don't feel protected, especially when you think about sexual harassment, sexual misconduct in the workplace. If there is a victim in those cases that want to keep their incident confidential and private, there's ways we can go about that without forcing these people into a non-disclosure agreement. Because at the end of the day, it's not the perpetrator that has to be forced into these non-disclosure agreements. It is the victim. And it's a victim across the board because, you know, I read back articles from 2011, 2015 from the Boston Globe as far as non-disclosure agreements. This is not a new issue. This is something that's being used for years. And the Globe also did, some investigations as far as non-disclosure agreements. And they're used to silence people, good workers, for bad behaviors within state agencies. And that is something that is unacceptable, and we should be looking into that.
Is this the, do you see this bill and this report as start of a broader effort to maybe govern the actual use of non-disclosure agreements in the future and the different things, the different options? Maybe you could say that non-disclosure agreements are only eligible to be used with taxpayer money if you're talking about pending legislation or something to that effect.
So, you know, I think my point of view is that what I'm trying to do is ban the use of non-disclosure agreements completely. Non-disclosure agreements were used for trade secrets and protecting valuable information and that sort of thing, instead of being used to just cover up bad practices within an agency. I think especially with, you know, public funds, we should not be having these silencing agreements, which doesn't allow transparency for government, for the public, to see how their funds are being used and allocated in these type of agreements.
What are you hearing for feedback from, whether it's from the press or from constituents in regards to this push for reforming NDAs?
What have I heard?
Yeah, what have you, whether it's questions from the press or even from constituents in regards to it, is there anything that has been asked that you're like, that's a good question, and that's something that needs to be to researched?
From constituents, I've gotten positive feedback, most definitely. I've had people reach out to me across the Commonwealth thanking me for taking on this issue and for calling for a state audit to find out exactly where it's being used, how it's being used, and how much is attached to these agreements. I've had people thanking me and sending emails to their own representatives, but also forwarding me those emails as well to bring light to the fact that they're listening and they also want answers. From the press, I mean, we've had the Boston Globe and Herald cover the stories, and it's been pretty positive on what we're doing. I believe it's a bipartisan issue. I believe it's good government and transparency. You can't go wrong with transparency.
Before we end our segment, we wanted to get your comment and the thoughts on the fiscal 2020 budget, finally being signed into law. How does it feel to have your first budget behind you, and what do you think of the overall budget itself?
It's very exciting to have it behind me. it was definitely a long process. I think longer than most expected. We had a new Ways and Means chair that took on this budget and took it very seriously, and I think he did an excellent job in doing so. You know, I believe we could have hopefully have gotten it out sooner, and hopefully next year we do get it out sooner. But I'm positive that, you know, with the understanding of his role and how it's played out, he'll be able to do it next year. But I'm happy it's, you know, in the books, and we're able to go forward with moving forward to fiscal year 2021, which is hard to think.
Yeah, it's right around the corner.
It is.
So I have to ask you, it's kind of informal sessions now in the House. Are you working on anything, or are you taking a much-deserved rest until the fall?
So we're actually, the office and I, with my legislative aide and my intern, we're going to be in the district, and we're going to go around to the small businesses and meet small business owners and the different people within the community in the month of August. So I think it'll be nice to see some familiar faces and meet some new faces as well.
Well, we want to thank you very much for joining us yet again. You did it 2 weeks in a row. We opportunity to kind of talk a little bit about the press conference last week, and then this week to kind of really give an expanded conversation on the non-disclosure agreement reform bill. If there are any updates, we definitely look forward to hearing back from you. And we're going to get the band back together, whether it's yourself, Representative Lenatra, or Moschino, get you guys back in before the end of the summer, too.
Sounds good.
Yes, definitely. I would love that. I think they would love it, too. I know I have to give a little shout-out because Rep. Lenatra gave her maiden speech last Wednesday, and she did a phenomenal job. So congratulations to her. So now we can debate on the House floor, which is an exciting time.
Yeah, she was actually on, I would say Friday, she was on TV. They did one of the TV stations doing their zip trip, and she happened to be on with another freshman legislator, Norm Oral.
Oh, yes.
So, Kathy getting some FaceTime and getting some radio time.
She is. She's awesome.
Well, listen, enjoy yourself, and we look forward to talking to you real soon.
Yes, thank you, guys. Have a good one.
Thank you, Representative. Bye-bye. Representative Allison Sullivan joining us for a few moments here. And your thoughts on the segment?
Great segment. I mean, the budget is the hot button issue.
How so? I mean,
as far as
how would it be a hot button?
The lateness of it. Yeah. Last state in the United States of America to pass a budget for this fiscal year.
But if you look at compared to the federal government, I think Massachusetts.
Well, the feds are their own monster.
Okay. Good to know. Are you looking forward to our upcoming conversation? We're expecting the congressman to be joining us. What are you looking forward to talking with the congressman about?
Definitely not looking forward to it, no. Because it's not a happy
issue. I know, you're
issue,
just looking forward to at least the
but the conversation about the mass shootings, of course, this past weekend. And his trip down to the border.
Yep. U.S.-Mexican border and
the conditions down there.
Yep. So we'll look forward to that in just a couple of moments here. Congressman Lynch warming up the bullpen. He'll be joining us in a few moments here on Monday Night Talk, heard on 95.9 WATD. Stay tuned.
Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
The new patio at McGuigan's offers alfresco dining in downtown Whitman. Seafood lovers will love the shrimp scampi, lobster leg tacos, and fish tacos. If you prefer something meatier, the patio's braised short rib dinner and 14-ounce pork chops are customer favorites. Into the latest food trends? Try the patio's Beyond Burger and flatbread pizza. The patio has 7 55-inch TVs and a 9-foot video wall, making it the perfect place to eat, drink, and socialize. And don't forget McGuigan's Pub next door. They're located at 546 and 552 Washington Street in Whitman.
This weight loss segment brought to you by Signature Healthcare, providing a team approach to weight loss, including medical and surgical options. Here's Dr. Deborah Abeles, chief of Signature Healthcare's Weight and Wellness Center in Brockton.
When it comes to medical or surgical weight loss, patients now have more options than ever before. At our practice, we're always trying to guide patients to the option that makes the most sense for them. So for some, that may mean surgery to help them lose weight, put their diabetes into remission, or reduce the number of medications that they take. However, there are also less invasive options like our 12-week doctor-supervised medical weight loss program. Patients work with our dietitian and lifestyle counselors while receiving ongoing physician consultation to make sure they are losing weight safely and effectively.
To learn more about Dr. Abeles and see if Signature Healthcare's medical and surgical weight loss approaches may be right for you, visit mysignaturecare.org/weightloss.
Okay, so here we are back for another segment of Monday Night Talk. And Matt, joining us is the one and only U.S. Representative serving the Massachusetts 8th Congressional District. We have Congressman Stephen Lynch once again joining us. Congressman, thank you very much for joining us this evening, sir.
Hello, Kevin. Hello, Matt. Good to be with you.
Thank you so much, sir. So I guess the first thing that I want to ask you right out of the gate, and I know your time is limited, is we saw two more mass shootings this weekend, one in El Paso, Texas, the other in Dayton, Ohio. Give me your thoughts on, yet again, two mass shootings where nearly 30 people lost their lives and many more were seriously injured.
Right. Horrific. I don't think there's any other way you could describe it. You know, I had just been down in El Paso the day before the shooting. We had gone down there to you know, look at the border situation. And the irony here that, you know, the El Paso community is extremely inclusive and welcoming of immigrant families. You have a lot of those shelters down there that are being used not only on the El Paso side, but also Ciudad Juarez, are supported by local communities, the churches, you know, the Rotary Club, you know, just different groups that just try to help out families that are struggling, in a lot of those immigrant families. And, you know, to have this screed of anti-immigrant venom, and then, you know, the act of terror against those families is just unthinkable. And, you know, I cannot think of something that is so, I don't know, offensive to really the true character and meaning of that whole community there. You know, they are a border community, so right. They have been dealing with this for, you know, over a century, and they've gone through the good and the bad, and this is really the worst to have. I think now 22... two more of the victims that were wounded passed away today, and so that's terribly tragic. And Dayton, Ohio, as well, just unthinkable in terms of what the shooter did in that case, where, you know, he executed his own sister and then, you know, took out I believe 8 others as well. So just horrific. And you know, it really is time for Congress to act with respect to, you know, the gun laws dealing with these high-capacity weapons. You know, the only reason someone would want an AR-15 is to kill a lot of people in a hurry. And there's no real sporting their purpose there. It's a, you know, it's a horrific weapon. And, you know, we have to, I think, make very, very sure that someone who applies for one of those weapons, you know, they have to have an even more aggressive background check to make sure that, you know, psychologically, they are responsible and, you know, appropriate to have such a weapon.
So a lot of the talk, Congressman, has switched over to, what can Congress do as far as legislation goes? We know that the House actually passed a bill, and it's moved on to the Senate, but Senator Majority Leader McConnell...
Mitch McConnell
is kind of refusing to let it be voted upon on the floor. Do you think that has anything to do with kind of preventing these kinds of attacks, and what can every congressman and congresswoman do as a whole to kind of push gun legislation through the House and the Senate?
Well, he's got two bills down. And the H.R. 8 was the broader bill that included, you know, enhanced background checks. I think if there's one single measure that we can take, I think it is to separate the people who shouldn't have guns from those weapons. And that's essentially what a background check would do. So right now, sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk is a bill that we passed in the House months ago, which would do exactly that. There are other bills that also were sent over there as well, but that is I think the biggest piece. There are two bills that I think are you know, worthy of passage that we sent over. I voted for. I think almost all Democrats did. And even some Republicans. So we sent it over months ago, and you know the obstruction here is completely within Mitch McConnell's control. He's the one that's stopping this. He doesn't want, you know, the NRA, unfortunately, has a stranglehold on Mitch McConnell, and he is the person. You know, we could do this very quickly. We could call the Senate into session. They could take that bill up. The president has said that he supports not only this bill, you know, the enhanced background checks, but he also talked about a red flag bill, which would, you know, look at individuals who have a psychiatric imbalance to describe it generally, but to make sure that those individuals do not have weapons. I know we have two bills in the House. I think Mr. Cicilline of Rhode Island has one with that specific focus. There's also an assault weapons ban that has been drafted as well. Those are all worthy of debate, and I think they would, you know, collectively, make a difference. I think it would save thousands of lives if we had enhanced background checks. I really do.
Do you feel that the incidents that we've seen are a combination of issues with high capacity weapons and maybe mental illness, and both of these there needs to be further legislation, as you're saying, that we need to have background checks, make sure that individuals who are seeking to have a weapon, that in fact that they pass certain safeguards to make sure that they are going to, you know, be proper gun owners?
Exactly. And it has to be a national standard. It has to be it has to be passed by Congress. You can't have 50 states doing their own thing. I think the shooting out in California, also, which happened recently, that individual could not purchase the weapon in California, so he went over to Nevada, bought the weapon, came back, and then, began to execute people. So we need a national standard, one that is thorough, one that is, you know, adopted by all 50 states in terms of, you know, who they allow to have weapons. Obviously you have states like Massachusetts that the gun laws are fairly strict. But then you have others that, some of the southern states, some would argue New Hampshire, but I think they've tightened up their laws more recently. So they're sort of in the middle of the pack, I think, with respect to regulation. But, obviously we need to all get together on this so that, you know, one weak state, doesn't continue to proliferate these high-capacity weapons and other weapons among people who should not have them.
Yeah, we're speaking with Congressman Stephen Lynch in one of our first topics, talking about the two mass shootings that took place over the weekend. And during your answering to the first question that was posed to you, you mentioned about your trip down to the U.S.-Mexican border to take a look at the humanitarian conditions, whether it was the migrant shelters or the processing facilities. What were you able to glean out of your visit?
Well, there have been significant changes since other members of Congress went down a couple of months ago and reviewed the facilities, Customs and Border Patrol facilities and the processing facilities on the border. Back in May, there were reports of extreme overcrowding in temporary processing centers. So these weren't even areas that were built or designed to hold people for long periods of time. And not only were they holding people for long periods of time, they were double and triple capacity of what they were designed for. So there were some areas that we saw, and I was accompanied by 24 other members of Congress, a couple of whom had been down there on multiple occasions. One of them, Veronica Escobar, who was from El Paso, and she was pointing out facilities where, you know, areas where, you know, 1,000 people were being held. And when we went there, the makeshift shelters had been disassembled. The Quonset huts had been torn down. New facilities had been built. And in that same area now, maybe 24 people were being held for processing. And they were fully stocked with supplies, not only for adults, but for children as well. So, and in addition, the Trump administration and Customs and Border Patrol and ICE have adopted a different policy now. Instead of trying to bring all of the detainees into one facility, or all of those people seeking asylum into one facility on the west border. What they do now is they do a threshold assessment as people come in, and then they refer them back to shelters on the Mexican side of the border in Ciudad Juarez. And those shelters are much more able, and they are designed for holding people for longer periods of time. You know, they have all the support staff, and they are built out, you know, for with beds and mesh, you know, showers, and so those are much better. That's a much better environment for families who are trying to come across to wait until they are processed further at a later date. There are complaints that it's taking too long. There are only CBP is taking, you know, maybe a couple dozen at a time and processing them, you know, trying to determine whether or not those individuals have viable claims of persecution, which would make them eligible for asylum. So there were complaints that by pushing people over the border, making them wait longer periods of time, you may discourage some or even put people in danger, because some of those towns on the Mexican side of the border, you know, are controlled by gangs. And so there's high levels of crime there. And so you may put some of those vulnerable families, especially those with children, in greater danger while they're waiting to be processed. So I think there may be a challenge, a legal challenge against that practice. That practice is called Migrant Protection Protocol. That's what the administration has entitled it. So that may be challenged legally by some of the advocate groups. The other process that we saw there is called metering, which when applicants for asylum or people trying to enter the U.S. Come across the pedestrian bridge, there are a couple of Customs and Border Patrol officers that review licenses and travel documents, you know, birth certificates. And if the person is not entitled to be in the U.S., they refer them back to the Mexican authorities. The Mexican authorities give them a 180-day visa to stay in Mexico. Many of these people are from several different countries, the Northern Triangle, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And they go back and basically await processing as well. They're given a temporary Social Security card in Mexico, Mexican card, and also there are employers from the maquiladoras that were looking for workers, so trying to offer some of those people the opportunity to go to work. But they would be living at the maquiladoras, and those settlements aren't ideal either for families. We were able to go into the ICE detention facility on the U.S. side. That houses more of the people who have been arrested either for crimes in the U.S. or multiple attempts to enter the U.S. illegally. There were 840 inmates the day that I was there, representing 79 different countries, which is hard to believe. 79 different countries. We spoke to one young man from Azerbaijan. There were people from Togo. There was a young man from Fairhaven, Massachusetts, not right next door to New Bedford, that I met. He actually recognized me, and we had a conversation. But he was there for multiple illegal attempts to come into the country. He was being removed because of his, you know, he admitted he had come into the country several times illegally, and I believe he might have had a DUI as well. A tough situation. Like I say, the problem hasn't been solved. I think it's merely been pushed over into Mexico while those people are waiting for their claims to be adjudicated.
All right, Matt, we've got a couple of minutes left with the congressman. Do you have a follow-up question in regards to his visit to the border?
Yes, there was a House resolution, I believe it's H.R. 3239, which is called the Humanitarian Standards for Individuals in Customs and Border Protection Act, that passed the House a couple of weeks ago. How do you think this will change what's currently happening at the border? And in the same token, is it going to elevate the standards of these immigrants stay in these facilities?
Well, Mitch McConnell has said the Senate will not take that up. So we had done a bill earlier about a month ago, where McConnell had agreed. That was the one where we provided $4.7 billion to basically build new facilities and correct the problem that was down there. ICE and Customs and Border Patrol have been spending some of that money. They told me that they had spent about $197 million rebuilding some of these new facilities. So that was the one that there were 83 votes for that in the Senate. And there were, you know, it was widely supported in the House as well. I think we had, 300 votes out of 435 members in the House. So right now, the measures that we've been doing, we've been sort of pre-negotiating with the Senate as to what bills will come up. And Mitch McConnell, the majority leader in the Senate, has told us that that bill that we passed that you just described will not be taken up for the Senate. So I'm doubtful that it'll be taken up in the upcoming months. Obviously, we're trying to get him to take up some of the gun control legislation that the House has already passed and has been sitting on his desk for several months.
We're going to transition away from talking about the border to something I think that everybody can identify with, and that is robocalls. It seems as though they have increased, and it's not just like from another state. Nowadays, folks who are sending robocalls, they're doing it and being able to access local numbers. I believe that the bill actually passed a bill to stop bad robocalls. What will this legislation hope to do if it can at least make it to the Senate and be passed?
Well, the idea is to respect people's privacy and not and allow them to basically ban unwanted calls. So I think it's a good measure. Back when we had landlines, it was much more easy and much more effective, to do robocalls back in the day. Now, very few people have landlines anymore, but the internet service providers and some of these platforms like Facebook, for instance, sell that information to their advertisers and other commercial entities. So what they're doing is basically, not only because of all the data they have access to, Facebook I'm talking about, they also have phone numbers, they have all your personal information, who your friends are, a rich, granular level of information on each of the users. They've got 2.7 billion customers. So that information is very valuable, and I think what they're doing is they're selling it to, these mobile numbers that are personal to the individual. Those are, rather than just the household, those are being sold to, commercial marketers, and they're using the robocalls, to push their products or services. And obviously, they're willing to sell them to political campaigns as well for that purpose. So hopefully we can get agreement on that will not be allowed. But, it's an ongoing struggle. There are some powerful commercial interests that want to continue to use that technology and access for commercial purposes.
Talk about one thing that affected the Brockton area recently was the passing of Bill Carpenter. I know you were a close friend with him, helping to campaign and yep. Attending his annual State of the City address.
Actually speaking during the State of the I think the most recent one, this early this year, right, Congressman?
Right.
Go ahead.
So, yeah.
What made Bill so special as an elected official and as a personal friend to you?
He was a joy. He was just, you know, he was totally committed to the people of Brockton. That's a tough job being mayor of Brockton. You know, I have worked with several, four in my time in office, and going all the way back to Jack Units. And Bill Carpenter was a man of the people. He was relentless in terms of, you know, working on the problems, and he was a frequent flyer to my office, you know, in his early days. I tried to, you know, he was so passionate. He it was contagious, the passion that he felt for the people of Brockton. He was able to, which is a requirement, I think, in office these days, is to kind of, you know, let the criticism roll off his back like water off a duck's back, you know, and he would just keep going. He just loved his job. He, like I said, he was relentless and tireless in terms of his efforts on behalf of people. He was, you know, we first worked closely together on the opioid issue. You know, we both saw the devastation that was causing, and he was truly committed to that cause, and that's really where we got to work closely together. And then, of course, we worked on a dozen different issues affecting Brockton. He was my partner. He came down to D.C. on a regular basis, probably of all the elected officials who, you know, would come down and work with me in Washington and work the other members as well, and our senators. You know, Bill Carpenter was by far the most active and really effective. You know, I had gone to his dad's funeral, and his dad had passed maybe a month before Bill had. And I remember, you know, physically, I had talked to his staff in the parking lot after I came out of that wake for his father, and I said, you know, he needs to get some rest. You know, he's just burning the candle at both ends. He looked tired. You know, he was literally working himself to death on behalf of the people of Brockton. And, you know, that leaves a big hole. I'll tell you, he was perfect for that job. He really was. He was a funny, you know, he was pee your pants funny. You know, amidst all of the stress and things like that, you got to be able to laugh. You got to be able to poke fun at yourself. And Bill was all of that. And he was a pleasure to work with. You know, he just had such an unthinkable optimism, regardless of what was going on. And like I say, he was a joy to work with. And I really miss him. And the people of Brockton chose very wisely when they chose him as mayor. You know, he had that slogan, "It takes a carpenter to build a city," and there was a lot of truth in that. And you know, now we're going to have to go about the difficult task of finding a replacement for Bill Carpenter. And you know, if we can get someone to fill one of his shoes, that'll be doing something. But he leaves a tremendous legacy. He had a wonderful family. Loved them all dearly, and you know, good family man, and his personality, you know, he was like a bulldog, and just a wonderful reflection, I think, of the city of champions. You know, he really did personify Brockton in so many, many ways. You know, there was no backstep on his part. There was no let up. You know, and like I say, he was a ball of energy, and I will miss him.
Well, Congressman, we want to thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule, your busy schedule, to join us here on Monday Night Talk and talk about so many different issues. We look forward to the next time we can have you join us and chat up, hopefully, things that are more of a positive direction than some of the things we had to address during our conversation this evening.
I would enjoy that very much, Kevin and Matt. Let's do this again very soon.
Sounds like a plan. Thank you so much, Congressman.
All right, take care. Have a good night. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye now.
You got it. There he is, Congressman Stephen Lynch joining us for a few moments here. I think I didn't realize that he was going to. What I like to do sometimes, Matt, is let our guest talk a little bit. But he really, normally he's usually really quick and has, you know, he'll have a 20 or 30 second response. But it seemed like he was really, especially when we're talking about, you know, the two shootings this weekend, he really wanted to weigh in on that.
The passion absolutely comes out in the topics we covered. And I mean, that's part of the reason that he's Congressman Lynch has been Congressman Lynch for so long now.
Indeed. And that wraps up our first hour, and we're going to step aside. And when we come back, David Cade, a rising star as an actor, we'll talk with him in just a few moments here on Monday Night Talk, heard on 95.9 WATD. Stay tuned.
South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
I'm Tiny of Tiny Sun's Glass. If you're driving along right now and you've got an angry little ding in your windshield.
Ouch!
But good news, we can fix that ding. We'll fix that ding before it spreads. Drive on over to Tiny & Sons, Route 53 Pembroke. We will fix that ding. Your insurance company will pay.
And that's why I sing, give me that ding.
So give me that ding. Tiny & Sons Glass will fix that ding. Insurance company will pay.
That's right.
My dad did a great job. 1-888-64-TINYS. Just call.
The new patio at McGuigan's offers alfresco dining in downtown Whitman. Seafood lovers will love the shrimp scampi, lobster leg tacos, and fish tacos. If you prefer something meatier, the patio's braised short rib dinner and 14-ounce pork chops are customer favorites. Into the latest food trends? Try the patio's Beyond Burger and flatbread pizza. The patio has 7 55-inch TVs and a 9-foot video wall, making it the perfect place to eat, drink, and socialize. And don't forget McGuigan's Pub next door. They're located at 546 and 552 Washington Street in Whitman.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen, say something. Call 781-837-4900. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
We are back, hour number two. And already joining us, she's in studio. She's coming up at 7:30. We've got Nicole Terry, who is here. Thank you for coming early.
Thank you for inviting me.
You got it. She's ready. Of course, you know her from Naked and Afraid. Just a few weeks ago, the finale of Naked and Afraid XL. We're going to talk about that. And we're going to talk a little bit about her love of sharks. Her significant other, Shane Lewis, is going to be calling, joining us. I have given permission that if he wants to tease me about being a Boston Red Sox fan, he can do that.
Yeah, he can do that.
But so she's here. We'll be hearing from them at 7:30. But joining us right now is a gentleman who is following the footsteps of Hollywood triple threat icons such as Tom Hanks, John Krasinski, Leonardo DiCaprio. David, welcome to Monday Night Talk, my friend.
Hey, Kevin. How you doing, man? Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, I know that recently released was Into the Ashes, and you're not just a good-looking guy, but you kind of do it all. You're a writer, a producer as well?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And hopefully a director on one of these runs here. We'll see what we get cooking. But, yeah, full package.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. No, I'm not alone. I want to warn you, I have my co-host, the Mad Dog. Matty Nelson is here, and he's a big movie guy. He loves TV, so He's gonna have questions as well. What got you a guy from what St. Paul, Minnesota? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I was born in St. Paul and I lived in a lot of different places in the Twin Cities. I moved about 13 times. Mm-hmm. I really thought as a kid I was gonna be a boxer. I really did, man. I competed in wrestling and I loved fighting. And when I was coming through college, that's what I got recruited for, was in wrestling. And so that was kind of my first passion. And I eventually left to go and pursue my BFA in acting. And I was there for about a year before I went to the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco, started studying theater and getting sort of accustomed to California lifestyle, which is pretty different for a Midwest boy. And I got my first job there, which was in Gus Van Sant's Milk. It was my first gig ever, which I almost turned down because I didn't want to miss acting class, and then realized, what are you doing? Go on set, go.
Okay.
And then I came down to LA when I was about 19 years old. I've been grinding ever since.
God bless you. Well, you know, you're sitting here, you're talking about being a wrestler and a boxer. I'm surprised you didn't want to combine the two and be the next MMA sensation and be, you know, a face in the UFC.
You know, it's funny. I sometimes get nostalgic, I think like every high school and early college athlete does. I go, I wonder if I was, you know, could I have been, what could I have done, you know, and I have that. But ultimately, the thing for me was my first ambition was always in the arts. It just wasn't accessible to me as a kid. Okay. And so I really felt like, you know, if you pursue athletics, you're only going to go till, what, mid-30s?
Yeah, and your body gives out.
Early 40s if you're lucky. Yep. Yeah, your body gives out. Whereas I just had this passion for film and acting in general, but it started in film. It started watching, you know, Pulp Fiction and, you know, Tarantino's movies out this weekend. So I'm thinking about that a lot. Or, you know... Gus Van Sant's earlier work, or you know, Matt Damon when he did Good Will Hunting. These were all things that, to me, that was it. And actually, I tell this story a lot, but it's 100% true. The first, I knew that I was going to be an actor because I went to an outdoor movie theater, probably like 99-2000 with my dad, and they played a double feature. The double feature was Gladiator.
Ooh.
And then American Beauty, right? And, dude, for a 12-year-old kid, that was the 1-2 punch. I just saw that, and I said, that's it. That's the greatest thing you can do. You know, and I was looking at it as an actor at that point in my life, you know, to be able to play those two different characters, but also just to tell those kinds of stories to me is, you know, that's why I do it. I love that.
Mad Duck, do you have a question?
So... your first film role was was Milk, and it won the big one, the Academy Award.
Right, that's Sean Penn.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I mean, nobody knew I was in it, but yeah, it was pretty cool. It was a great first experience. Getting to watch Sean Penn as literally my first day on set, right? 18, 19 years old, and I get bumped up from a waiter to a little speaking role opposite of Steve Spinella, who's Tony Award-winning actor, fantastic guy. I always remembered him as one of the actors from The Jackal with Bruce Willis back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think he's the guy that Bruce is, like, having a affair with to, like, get closer to Richard Gere. I don't entirely remember, but that's Steve Spinella. So... I got to meet him, and then Steve showed me off and met me. You know, I introduced me to Gus, and I got to meet Sean, which was a huge influence on me. To see your first actor on set is Sean Penn. And by the way, I met him as Harvey. I didn't meet him as Sean Penn. He introduced himself to me as Harvey.
Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
So how do you keep yourself composed? You're being walked over to Sean Penn, and you're like... You know, this is my moment. Don't say anything that's, you know, out of character. You know, just be like, hey, how you doing? Nice to meet you. But what's going through your head as you're walking over to him?
I mean, listen, man, you don't keep composure. That's what happens. I didn't fall apart, but I just remember this. I don't blush much. I've met a lot of celebrities, worked with people a lot. I blushed meeting Shantae. My whole face got red. It was like this stupid smile I couldn't wipe off my face. It was just it was a great experience. And he was so kind to me. Even though he maintained being in character and he was, still being Harvey Milk, he was 100% a gentleman and warm. And so I really appreciated that because none of that had to happen.
So you've had other performances. I mean, you've been in Scrubs, Pretty Little Liars, and let's not forget Big Time Rush.
Big Time Rush. Yeah, a lot of comedy, actually, which I love. I think that I kind of have a special little niche there, being sort of the all-American comedic guy. But I really loved it. Big Time Rush is huge. Big Time Rush gave me a fan base, gave me a break, gave me fans around the world, and that was amazing.
You talk about you've being likened to a DiCaprio or a Hanks. I mean, look where Hanks started out. He started out as being a funny guy in sitcoms, and look where he is now.
Totally. I heard somebody told me one time that you could always pull a comedic actor down, but you can't always pump a dramatic actor up. And I think that there's some truth to that. If you have those comedy chops, if you're able to let go of your ego for the sake of a joke, right, then it also seems to translate, if you're given the opportunity, to some really good dramatic performance.
So you've, I want to use the word graduated. You kind of graduated from TV into big film, especially from the early shows, the Big Time Rush, that's got a younger audience, and now you're into a more serious role in
Mature,
Into the Ashes.
Mature roles, yeah.
Tell us about what it's been like to kind of shift yourself from early comedy children audience to a more serious adult mature audience.
I love it. My hope is that, this is painting a different version of me for the future, right? What I love about Ashes is that, independent of how any one person feels about the particular film, the film speaks to the tone of stuff that I want to be doing and how I want to be perceived, right? And so, I'm a young guy now, and I feel like getting this sort of street cred underneath me and doing this complicated kind of part with actors that I really respect, and who are all older than me, right? I'm the baby on the production still, is going to help line me up over the next 10 years, because one of the guys I talk about a lot is Joel Edgerton. And Joel is a fantastic actor and a writer and a director. And I look at where he's at now. He's about 10, 11 years older than me, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I'd like to be. And I think that Ashes is helping open that up, and it's helping people see me in a different light.
Yeah, talk to us about your production company, North of 84, because isn't this a residual? What Into the Ashes is produced from is North of 84?
Yeah, so that's my company.
Yep.
Which teamed up along with the film community to help make the film. And I started that 2 years ago, essentially as a way to house the projects that I was writing. Yeah, I wanted a company to own the IP. And so this is the first film that's come out of that. And it's made me start thinking about the business as a much larger entity, right? And so I have my projects, which are numero uno, that I've written. I have a couple projects that are underneath us that are helmed by people that I love to work with. And what I hope is to actually, over the years, build something similar to what Plan B has built, where the quality of the project and the actors getting attached to it, start to make its own business separate from my own acting career.
Well, and I see with Ashes, you actually you're right alongside Frank Grillo, a guy who I know fondly from. I'm a big fan of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and folks know Frank. I know Frank from portraying Brock Rumlow or Crossbones in a couple of the Captain America movies.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, he just had his little cameo in Endgame.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Frank was great. He's a super cool guy. I love what him and Joe Carnahan. I was actually. So, my favorite film of Frank's is The Gray with Joe Carnahan directing. I love that film. I think he's great in it. And he was an awesome dude to work with and super supportive. So I hope to work with them again. I think what they're doing over at Warp Party, his production company, is fantastic. And so, you know, we've kept in touch, and I'm hoping that there's going to be more down the line. We shall see.
Are you looking to kind of just be able to have your own projects and be able to see if bigger outlets are willing to help finance and help you put forth some of those projects under your own umbrella?
That's certainly a part of it, right? That's certainly a part of it. But the other thing is that, you know, the way that I view the industry now, and it's funny, I talk about this a lot with people. You know, I think that the system 10, 15, 20 years ago was really a star-based system.
Yeah.
And that means that you could come in and it could just be a couple names on top of the film, and all of America would come and see it, or at least enough to make your money back as a filmmaker. And the way that the business has shifted now, stars are less important, content is most important. And so I really see star power being attached to your ability to create content, not just look pretty on the matinee. And so for me, I just want to open up as much opportunity as possible by creating my own project, making projects with people that I really like. I just love their work, and allowing that to be synergistic with my career and not having to rely on one or the other, you know? Absolutely. I want to finance bigger projects with bigger companies and create the street cred able to do that. I think Ashes is a big step in that direction.
Yeah. How did Ashes come to be? If you wouldn't mind giving us the backstory, how did you come to be a part of that and have it, and how was it received?
So the director is a co-writer of mine on a project I've been developing for a while, and he's a good friend. And so when he had told me, he came out with a film previously called The Neighbor, which is actually a cool little film. It was like one of the top downloaded off of Amazon for a few weeks and all that. Michael Rosenbaum, Bill Fichtner, cool group. So he had just got this film, and he had the script in his hand for Ashes, and I love his writing. It's part of the reason that we collaborate together. And the conversation became, how do we get this moving? what do we do to get this moving? I was looking for a project to sink my company's teeth into, and that started the dialogue. We were really fortunate to have a lot of help. Our producing partner, Rob Barnum, was super helpful to us, and getting Frank and Luke early on helped us enormously in terms of getting the financing. And, you know, 2.5 years later, now it's out and about. And I think that the reception for it is pretty good. It depends on where you're asking, right? We knew that it was a controversial type of film to make because it was a pulled back noir genre film. And we knew that was going to come out the gate. But we've also gotten validation from people that really seem to get that. And, you know, the Richard Roper Sun Times review for us was really heartwarming, you know, because that's somebody we respect a lot. And he gave us 3 out of 4 stars. LA Weekly wrote a great review about us.
Wow.
We've had people that have really supported the film. So insofar as that's happened, that's great. I think a lot of people go and see it and they don't entirely get it. And, you know, to them, I apologize because I want a great film for everybody to see always. But I also understand that for us, it created a specific reputation. And I think that was a good thing in the long term.
How deep do you get into the process? Are you like, besides being someone who's a producer, being in front of the camera, helping with writing, are you the one who's in when they're doing editing and they're putting it together and helping kind of craft it that way as well? Or is that not necessarily your forte?
So actually, that's more my forte.
Oh, no kidding.
You know, Yeah, because learning the financing and the business side of it, that's going to be a couple of years, right? Like, I've learned a significant amount. I have a basic understanding of, you know, business and going out to investors and how to do that. But there are people that are better than that, right? There are people that have got 15-year-long, 20-year-long relationships with investors, with financiers, and those are a lot easier to make. That's not where I stand strong. There's guys who stand strong on the money. I stand strong on the creative producing, right? So that's, I'm good at coming in and going, okay, what are we trying to create here? What's this, you know, how do we, there's a great quote I read one time that I think is absolutely accurate. I'm trying to remember exactly, but basically it's like independent film is giving the audience 80% of what they want and 20% of what they didn't know they needed. And it's something like that. It's like, how do you give it, you know, how do you tailor an idea or a story in a way that's going to be received? So that's where I think I come into it. It's part of the reason that the filmmaking aspect for me is getting more pertinent, because I want to actually get my hands on it and make one for myself, and then we'll see how that goes. But I think that's where the direction I'm going, you know? It fits better in line with my skill set.
So your bio says that you had a fairly rough childhood growing up in St. Paul, and your one of your life's dreams is to give back to at-risk youth, realizing how vital a role that mentors played in your life. Can you talk a little bit about that, and who was your role model getting into the acting world?
I, by every metric, should have ended up in prison for the armed services of some branch, or debt. And I got real lucky early on, and I got a lot of purpose early on to help drive me out of that. But, you know, I bounced around. I think I lived 13 different places before I was 13. My dad left when I was a kid. A lot of financial stress, bad neighborhood, stuff like that. So, you know, for me, I was looked at by the state of Minnesota as an at-risk delinquent. I had a 1.6 GPA, an exceptionally high IQ, and I was in trouble all the time. And I was lucky enough to get into a program that no longer exists, that I became very close to my teachers, and I got a support structure, and I ended up, you know, graduating. And I also had wrestling, which, once I cared about, once I had that support structure of caring about something more, you know, higher than myself, and having a team and having people I couldn't let down and having coaches, really helped me. So, yeah, I think the shorter answer is there's a lot of people that, a lot of kids that get written off because they haven't been shown what they could accomplish. If somebody was just there to tell them it can be done. I had people that sort of made me feel like nothing was impossible if I was willing to work hard enough at it. And yeah, I want to provide that opportunity to kids. I want to go to kids who are having, you know, broken homes and moving out of, in and out of school systems and struggling with things. I want to be able to go to them and say, hey, listen, man, I was you. I get it. I've been there. And the difference between you walking out of here and holding your head high and not is the choices you make. And the opportunities you get. So I, for me, in terms of my role models, I've had many. Coaches, acting teachers, producing friends, writer friends. I really take as many role models as I possibly can to keep learning.
That's the key to success, is to continue learning, correct?
I would agree.
Yeah,
I would agree. It has to never stop. It's funny. I see a lot of people that their ego is so built around, especially in the creative field, it's so built around, I can't be wrong, because if I'm wrong, it means I'm not as good of a creative as I thought. And I just think that's so silly. I just think there's so many upgrades you can go. Just keep learning more.
Again, we're speaking with David Cade, actor, writer, producer, hopefully a director soon. Probably the last. I'm surprised, Matt, you didn't mention about his 4-octave scale range as a singer. I'm surprised you didn't bring that up.
The same range as one Freddie Mercury.
Yeah, that's right. So actually, funny enough, when, so, okay, real story. I didn't know how to sing as a kid, or like I didn't know that I didn't know how to sing, but I wanted to be an actor.
Okay.
And all we had in the school was musicals, right? So I went in and I said, listen, I don't know the first thing about this, but I can mimic sound. You give me a sound and I'll mimic it.
Oh.
And so she started giving me tones off the piano and I went really high. And she was like, you're a tenor. I was like, what's that? And she goes, that means you can sing high. And I went like, oh, you mean like Freddie Mercury? Yeah, my mom plays him all the time. I just try and copy him,
okay.
Right? And so as I've gotten older, my voice is sort of like a higher edge, rockier, more Chris Cornell kind of sound. But it's deceptive because, again, people look at me and they go, there's no way you can sing like that. And I go, watch this, right? And I love that. I really love it. I want to find a way to make music a part of my role at some point as well. But we'll see.
If folks want to find out more about you, if they want to find out more about Into the Ashes, which was out in the theaters a couple of weeks ago, how can they do that?
Find me at Cade Brigade, CadeBrigade, and that's on Twitter and Instagram. And keep Googling Into the Ashes, man. We're still playing around theaters around town. We're on video on demand, Amazon. We'd love for you to see it.
Dave, I want to thank you so much for joining us. And if there are more projects down the road, we'd definitely like to have you on to share with our audience.
I love it. I would appreciate that. And you guys are great. Thank you for having me.
Continued success.
Thanks, my brother. You too.
You got it. There he is. Dave All right. Cade.
All right.
Our guest for this segment of Monday Night Talk. Thoughts, Matt? Should we check your octaves? How many octaves do you have?
I get about a half an octave range. Not even a full one.
Are you any good at acting at all?
I act like I can sing karaoke.
Okay. enough questions for me.
Yes.
Well, it's time for us to step aside for a moment for our final segment. And again, I want to thank Nicole Terry, who's been very patient. She's our guest up next, our headliner for the program. You are listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. Don't go anywhere.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
The new patio at McGuigan's offers alfresco dining in downtown Whitman. Seafood lovers will love the shrimp scampi, lobster leg tacos, and fish tacos. If you prefer something meatier, the patio's braised short rib dinner and 14-ounce pork chops are customer favorites. Into the latest food trends? Try the patio's Beyond Burger and flatbread pizza. The patio has 7 55-inch TVs and a 9-foot video wall, making it the perfect place to eat, drink, and socialize. And don't forget McGuigan's Pub next door. They're located at 546 and 552 Washington Street in Whitman.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny & Sons Auto Glass in Pembroke. People ask me, is there anything they can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
Is there anything I can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
See? There is. Those big gravel trucks, when they're being loaded, rocks get stuck in the framework of the bed. Truck hits a bump, rock hits your windshield. It pays to stay way back.
It pays to stay way back.
However, if your windshield is broken, just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
Monday Night Talk continues all week long. Go to 95.9WATD.com/Monday Night Talk and keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Hey, so we're back for the final segment of Monday Night Talk. And it's a returning guest, as we promised a few weeks ago when we had her. Well, how long ago was that?
I think it was back in June. It was like maybe 2 weeks into the show.
2 weeks into the show. Anybody who's never seen it on the Discovery Channel, it's called Naked and Afraid. And there's a couple of different variations. They have the Naked and Afraid. That's where folks will go out and they have 21 days. It's usually a male and a female. And they're sent off into some of the toughest terrain. And they have to survive on their skills as a survivalist. Sometimes they get, I don't know if it's changed. It's almost like Survivor, when normally you'd have to go catch your own stuff. I think it's changed where I think they give you a fire starter and a knife, and then you can bring something. How does that work, Nicole?
Well, what you do is
bring in a variety of different items that you would want to use out on this particular location. It could be mosquito nets, yep, duct tape, a knife, fire starter, magnesium, anything really. And then you present it to the production crew, and you do not know what's going to be in that satchel until you're, you know, put on location.
Oh, my goodness. See, I didn't even know that. That's pretty cool. And what's in, folks can't see it. It's because it's not a visual medium. You actually have a shell of one of the things that you wear, so we can be able to pick up, so the production team can pick up your audio,
mm-hmm,
which is really, really cool. Again, Nicole Terry was here. Nicole, who also, during her time in college, I think you were an intern here, right?
I was, yes.
At WATD, working in the newsroom, working with the great Rob Hakala. When I reached out to her, she's like, yes, did you not know? And she kind of informed me that she had done an internship here, working here at WATD, doing some stuff. And it was fantastic to be able to talk with her, because I'm a big fan of the Naked and Afraid concept, not only the 21 days, but then to see teams try to tackle 40 days. And what was even different about this is within the 40-day challenge, you actually had two of veterans of Naked and Afraid.
Yes, we did.
You had Jeff and Laura Zara doing a 60-day challenge.
Oh, geez, yeah.
And there was kind of a social dynamic to that, because they kind of had a mindset to, like, on, if we're going to make it 60 days, we're going to have to fend for ourselves, and we'll be your neighbor, but we won't be your neighbor. And they kind of changed things, because there was a point in time where I believe Jeff got really, really sick at a particular time and realized that, well, maybe I can't do it on my own.
The night Jeff got sick, that was very scary, because he had been saying throughout the day he was feeling a little off, feeling a little hot, and put my hand on his forehead right before we called in the medics, and I have never felt a human body that hot before. So, I didn't want to see him get dragged out of there. So it's like we were all praying for him, you know, get healthy, get back soon, please. We want you to come. We're so close. You need to come across the finish line with us.
And what's fantastic is that I think Shane was on the first Naked and Afraid XL, Shane Lewis.
Yes, he was.
With Jeff and so many, EJ and so many other interviews. Like I told you, I did a little bit of, I did a little binge watching of Naked and Afraid XL the first season last night with Shane. And I think we might have Shane joining us at this moment. Just looking at my producer right now. And we do. I think we have Shane Lewis. Would you like to say hello to Shane?
Hi, Shane.
Hi, Nicole.
Hi, Shane.
How are you?
Shane, I got to say, I'm a fan of yours. I didn't realize until I did a little research that you were on, I think you were on the very first Naked and Afraid, were you not?
That is correct.
Wow. Wow. And then you were on the very first Naked and Afraid XL. That's where it is, you know, they send out teams, and then eventually the teams come together, and it's quite the dynamic.
Yeah, I'd say. Yes, yes. In some cases, the dynamic is the most difficult part of the challenge.
I will tell you, though, the one thing that I don't like about you is that you're a Yankees fan. as you know what, as you saw, that the Yankees had their way, not only out in London, but this past weekend with the Red Sox, who are fading ever so fast.
Did Nicole tell you we were at Saturday's game in the Bronx?
She did. She did tell me that. She's like, oh, it's horrible. The Red Sox, they didn't even stand a chance.
I enjoyed watching Cora get thrown out of the game. I wanted Martinez thrown out in the first thing when he tossed his bat and got in the umpire's face. I was like, dude, I agree it was a bad call, but that's, you know, get out.
That's baseball. But, you know, the Yankees, the Yankees are, I mean, right now, if you look at records, I mean, the Yankees are the best team in baseball right now. Mm-hmm.
From a certain point, Houston and LA started out with that great match. I just love the game, and Nicole will attest to this. I enjoy the rivalry. I've been to Fenway Park more times than I've been to Yankee Stadium in the last couple of years.
Have you really? That's fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, I go to Fenway Park at least once a year, sometimes twice. I love I love baseball, first off, and baseball sucks when both the Yankees and the Red Sox aren't good. So, to me, it's boring.
Yeah, it is. You're absolutely right. It is boring. I was telling Nicole, between our commercial breaks that I was supposed to go to Yankee Stadium. I was actually going to go, I want to say when they played, I forgot who they were going to play. I don't know. It was Toronto. And then we were going to make a trip to Philly, and we were going to watch the Phillies play. We're going to try to. I got a friend of mine who works for CBS Radio out there, and both he and I are baseball fans ourselves. We've taken in a Nats game, we've taken in an Orioles game. He's an Athletics game. He actually had Steve Lyons kind of give him the business a couple of months ago at Fenway Park because he was wearing an Oakland A's hat, and he took it in stride. But
that's pretty good.
Yeah, it is definitely pretty good. But we're not here to talk baseball. We're here to talk Naked and Afraid alum. What was it like for you, Shane, to see your significant other enduring a 40-day challenge?
To be honest, I haven't watched it yet because me and Nicole agreed that we weren't going to watch. I wasn't going to watch it until I could watch it in a binge watch setting. And we've been quite busy over the last few weeks and months since it's been airing. So I've seen a few episodes, and obviously I pay attention to what the fans say because it's my job to protect her. So I do what I have to do. And
Do people not understand?
I've only seen a couple episodes. I can tell you this much. When I picked her up at the airport, I definitely knew what happened to her. That's for sure. I was like, wow.
And what was that like? When he kind of already knew. He's like, oh, my God, you've changed, you know? What's that like when you sit, for the first time, you embrace your significant other?
Well,
and then have you told any stories at all, or have you held off until he watched it? Because he knows the editing, he knows what's going on, and knows that there's probably a whole lot more that has happened other than what we are watching.
Well, he did hear some stories. What I could tell him in the short period I was still in the Philippines after extraction, because we didn't hang around very long after we were extracted. We were on an airplane next to 12 hours later. When he hugged me, his arms were further around me than it otherwise normally would, almost maybe two or three times.
Oh, goodness.
Because I was down 26 pounds, so.
Wow.
Yeah. But the rest of the week that we saw each other, it was, story after story after story.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you take those stories, Shane, knowing that, again, you're somebody who's been invested, you've done this, you are a world traveler. I mean, you're not called Shane off the grid for nothing because you like to travel, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got addicted to it in my mid-30s that I went on a tear that was just, ridiculous. I was out of the country for 5 months a year for 11, 12 years straight.
See, me being kind of, I got like a producer mindset. I can see a show, Shane, with you and Nicole traveling the globe, 80 days around the globe. I can see it.
I do think we have explosive personalities enough to handle that, but you know what? I don't rate, so I don't make those decisions.
For folks who don't know, I mean, what is it like, Nicole, to survive a 40-day challenge? How was it so different from 21 days where you actually, it's times two?
Well, I mean, all of us out there had completed the 21-day challenge, and some of us even a 14-day challenge. So, in a way, your body is used to that kind of punishment. But once it passed the 21 days, the 21-day mark, you still have a few more weeks to go. You think to yourself, wait a minute, this isn't over yet. And about another week passes, at least for me, I can't speak for the others, felt myself getting a lot weaker than I was when I was out in Nicaragua right around the 21-day mark. I was a lot more fatigued. I mean, my sleeping was on and off, but it all depends on where you are, how you're feeling.
Bug bites.
Oh my gosh, those bug bites.
So I would ask you this, Shane. You're again a veteran of Naked and Afraid, somebody who has endured this. What do you, for folks who are out there watching this at home? I mean, what are some of the actual challenges that you are facing? Is it more or less you against, you know, that terrain, or is it a matter of a social element and being able to have people that you can actually work with and have a relationship with and be able to do things as a team?
I think the team aspect has to come first. That's my DNA. There are other survivalists who have a different aspect when they go out there and outlook on things. But for me, if the team is not functioning correctly, I'm not very comfortable. I don't want to struggle out there. I don't want to have all kinds of variables. I want to eliminate as many variables as possible for everybody involved that's around me. Because the more of us that are comfortable, the better off we're going to be, the more relaxed we're going to be, the more successful we're going to be. So that has always been my goal when I go out there. I was a little tyrannical and bombastic on the first one because the environment was unbelievably treacherous, and I just vented in the wrong ways on the S1, E1. But, you know, hey, you do what you do.
And just remind folks, where was that? Where was the very first Naked and Afraid XL?
It was in Costa Rica.
And what was that?
It was 100,000 hectares of virgin triple canopy jungle.
And did you feel like your head was on a swivel, you know, when it came to whether it was snakes or certain, you know, watching where you're stepping? I mean, or does that kind of, you know?
I'll put it to you this way. I'll put it to you this way. I've done 92 days, and that's not in an arrogant, braggadocious way. But the Costa Rica environment was the only environment where the camera crew and the production team, their footprint had no bearing on the deadly animals that were around us or stayed around us. The other animals didn't come around, but it did not make the deadly animals leave, like the deadly snakes and the deadly frogs and all that stuff. Never left our area. Leopards never left our area. I mean, there were paw prints out in front, like, you know, 10, 15 feet away. I mean, it was unbelievably treacherous. Every other environment I've been in, all the other places, and, you know, 15, 16 lodges that I've made across, you know, I don't know, two continents or something. But when the initial area is created by everybody involved, the human footprint is so intense that's why you don't see any kills at first, because it takes a little while for life to come back, and that's when you need things to settle down. And that's what I like. I like creating an environment where we can relax and be comfortable and let life come back to us so that we don't struggle as much.
Again, we're speaking with Shane Lewis and Nicole Terry, as they are veterans of Discovery Channel's Naked and Afraid and Naked and Afraid XL. I'm sorry, Matt. I'm like sitting here hogging because I'm fans of these two. Did you have a question, whether it's for Shane or for Nicole?
It's for both, actually. I'm getting two questions in one here.
Look at you.
You guys are...
Make sure you direct the question first so they know how to answer.
We'll start with Nicole.
Okay.
You guys are in a relationship, you and Shane.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever go camping, or is that like elementary school stuff now that you've survived?
It's a good question.
21 days, 40 days.
That is a good question.
With nothing.
Well, we love camping. We try to do it 3 to 4 times a year, whether it's up at a skydiving drop zone in Pepperell where you can pitch a tent, hang out for a weekend, or go to a campground somewhere. And whether it's in Maine or Vermont, actually 2 weeks after I got back from doing my first challenge, we were camping up in Maine.
Oh, goodness.
That must have been interesting.
It was.
Were you still like in recovery mode at that point?
I was. I was actually supposed to go out and run a back-to-back Tough Mudder that weekend, and I woke up the morning of and I just thought to myself, yeah, this isn't happening. I'm going back to bed.
And who would blame you? Now, do you want to repurpose the question to Shane?
Same question, Shane. You've, like you mentioned, survived 92 days out with just a few random items that you may or may not know what it is before you get to the locale. What's camping like for you?
Well, I... The challenges have changed my attitude. I normally don't kill things, regardless of what they are, unless I'm going to eat them. I do know how to hunt and kill and skin and do all of these things. I'm not great at some of them, but I can do them. But I have zero tolerance for mosquitoes and biting bugs now. So mosquito repellent is A number one. So it's kind of like, I'm like of a pansy now. You know, if I'm out for fun, you know, I've got tons of mosquito repellent. You know, I've got good hiking boots because there's nothing to come through the bottom of my boot and puncture my feet. It's like, no.
Do you guys ever practice, I guess, practice in real life, anything you've done on the show? Like
as far as
hunting,
being a survivalist?
Being a survivalist, yeah. Hunting, killing your own food, stuff like that.
Well, for me, I'm more in the foraging aspect because I don't have the heart to kill something outside of a survival situation. I mean, when I had a pellet gun, I shot a bird out of a tree and I cried for 3 days. But for me, it's, you know, I practice identifying plants, you know, deadly animals. I mean, we don't really have all that many poisonous animals around here, but we do have poisonous plants. You know, working on my land navigation and things like that.
Shane, same question to you, sir.
No, I don't. And I have a habit of practicing skills that I use when I'm out there. I'm not the best hunter out there, but if you give me a bow and give me the right environment, I will kill things. It's just, you know, I mean, I learned how to hunt when I was a kid. I grew up on a farm in one of the foster homes that I grew up in and learned how to kill and skin and, you know, eat just about everything. So I have no problem with it. I just, it's not my day-to-day practice.
If you could like isolate a moment, do you have a favorite moment, Shane, that during competing on whether it's the Naked and Afraid, the regular version or the XL version, do you have a favorite moment where you're like, this is me, I'm in the element?
Yeah, I would say, again, I go back to S1, E1, because that's probably the rawest that I will ever be on camera again. So the moment when I killed the Fertilance, although he didn't really have a fighting chance because he was sleeping, but...
So.
But I did kill, you know, a snake that nearly took off my producer's leg. So it was a pretty intense moment. Just turning around in that moment when it was finally dead and turning around and taking that, you can see on camera, and I turn around and I just take a few deep breaths. Like I turn my back to the moment. Like it's over, it's done with. I need a break. I need fresh air. I need a clean eyesight. I need to see something that isn't this pressure packed moment.
Right.
I think that's one of my favorite moments because it's just such a pure, raw, you know, instinctive, unfiltered reaction.
Same with you. You have a favorite moment, whether it's with you and another male or as part of this recent XL version. Do you have a favorite moment? I told you already what my favorite moment was when, you know, in the finale where everybody was kind of like, oh, no, what do we do? And you shined. I'm not going to say any more because Shane hasn't seen it. I don't want to be a spoiler here, but I was very happy for you knowing that you were able to. I like seeing each member having their moment to shine, and I get to see you shine, and I was very happy for you. What would you say would have been one of your favorite moments that won't totally spoil it for Shane? Although you've already kind of told the story, so it might not surprise him.
Well, let's see. I would have to agree with you that my favorite moment was when James and I brought the fish back to camp, but we were putting on that front hadn't caught anything super significant outside of something that was not even an inch and a half long. And it was very easy to get into that moment to really, you know, get into the role, so to speak, because we were so tired, we were hungry, dehydrated, and we both really weren't feeling 100%. And actually, at one point when we were putting on our little act, My eyes started welling up because I just saw all the all my fellow
all the faces sink.
They just look so dejected. I'm like, I'm sorry, guys. And then I started throwing the fish out of my satchel, and they're, oh my gosh!
It was time to feast.
Oh yes.
I will say the other thing that I noticed, and I'll be curious if Shane would be able to kind of say yes or no. With yours, where they kind of had like a feast, you guys all had like a little feast after it was all done. In your initial Naked and Afraid XL, there was no like this grand feast afterwards where they brought you to an area, was there?
I can't speak for that per se, because I tapped out on the initial X1 on day 31. I'd had enough.
Right.
I was told that there was a pretty good feast for them on the boat that picked them up on the islands.
So if I was to ask you, is there anybody that you stay in touch with as part of the survivalist world, as part of the Naked and Afraid that you've interacted with, Nicole?
Well, I haven't spoken to my partner for my 21-day challenge yet. But, you know, we never exchanged information, and he's not on social media, so there's really no way for me to track him down. But as far as the 40-day challenge, I still keep in touch with Angela, Riley, Gabby. I speak to Duke every now and again, James. I talk to Charlie and Duck. I haven't heard from Max, and I haven't spoken to Jeff. And a couple of the others I do talk with, but not as often.
As often. Anybody that you still interact with or speak with, Shane, from the Naked and Afraid family?
Me and EJ Snyder are very close.
Yeah, he's a heck of, when you've, in that Naked and Afraid XL, when you met up with him after you had the issues with your initial grouping, I was kind of happy to see you kind of hanging out with him.
Yeah, we've been friends for years before that. That's actually the first time I'd ever saw EJ with clothes on. The first time I'd ever seen EJ was that moment, and I was like, it was kind of weird to see him for the first time, knowing we were already pretty good close friends by that point.
Any thoughts of, there was a 60-day challenge. Would either of you ever entertain doing such a challenge?
Been done, so it doesn't mean anything to me.
Okay. So is there something on the horizon for either of you further on Discovery Channel that you may be entertained? What if they did like a, you know, if they did the 60, they did a 40, they did a 60, what's not to say that they're not going to try to push the gamut? Do you think it's something that would be, that would interest or pique your interests?
Well, for me, yeah, but I do have my priorities with school and things like that since I'm back in a program to further my nursing degree. But my life priorities come before making a decision to do the show again. I mean, I would love to do one, but I have to have my priorities sorted out before I can consider doing another one.
Excellent. Now, Shane, I don't know if you would do it or if you're continuing on the path of being an actor. Would you do another Naked and Afraid if it was something that hadn't been done before? Or are you looking at maybe some roles down the road?
Well, I'm always looking for roles. I have fought for my contract to be separate between scripted and unscripted. So that's something that I fought the right to. So neither one influences the other as far as what I feel like doing or what is presented to me.
Sure.
I do auditions all the time for acting all the time. That's kind of interesting. They come and go. It's funny. But if the location was right, you know, and they were going to give me some kind of, you know, assurance that I wasn't going to deal with children out there, I might consider it. But I just don't. I'm over dealing with children.
Okay. Because I was going to ask, because I could see you and Nicole, I could see you and Shane maybe doing something like An Amazing Race. Would that ever be something that would be on the radar?
Well, Shane and I have had conversations about the possibility of doing a challenge together, regardless of what it may be, but yep, we're the type of people who don't really want to put our relationship on display for mass media.
Yep.
But I mean, around the world thing, I wouldn't be opposed to.
That could be fantastic. That could be fantastic exploring. I was doing some research on some of the stuff on Shoe Shade, and there was one thing that one of the questions that it said was, are you afraid of getting stuck somewhere? And you're like, oh, no, I would just enjoy the ride. It's all part of the plan. It's a great answer.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, I can, like, I backpacked the world. I've spent 3 years of my life living in third world countries trying to figure out how to read the language and get bus schedules and hitchhike across, you know, jungles and stuff. It's fun. I enjoyed it. It's part of life experience, I guess. That's the DNA that I have. I've enjoyed all of my, I love being lost in a city. My first time in a foreign city, regardless of the language, I don't get a map or anything. I just walk around aimlessly and try to figure it out, lost. I get frustrated sometimes, but, you know, that's part of the plan.
Matty, you get the last question.
Funny how timing works. We talked about the Yankees in baseball, but, Nicole, you are a self-proclaimed shark nerd.
Yes.
Right.
And Shark Week. Shark just week. Wrapped up. So did you give us your thoughts on Shark Week and how you became a self-proclaimed shark nerd?
She did not want to be that girl that was on the paddleboard with bull sharks bumping the paddleboard.
Oh, I would have been all for that.
Okay.
Well, I've always had a big big interest in the ocean, nature, on land and at sea. And I'm a scuba diver. I got my scuba license at 16.
Fantastic.
But I didn't see my first shark in the wild until a few months ago when I was in British Virgin Islands and black-tip reef sharks were swimming around us at a wreck. They're severely misunderstood creatures, and now that... Cape Cod is kind of like the shark hot spot. Mm-hmm. I mean, my interest in them just grows more and more each year, and these creatures are indigenous to the oceans, and I mean, we kill millions of them each year for what? A bowl of soup. And it, I feel that my knowledge and my love for sharks can help, you know, others also develop an interest and possibly finding a way to protect them from extinction, because when our sharks die, our oceans will die.
And did you want Shane to answer that real quick?
Shane, how do you view sharks? Is it the same way? And did you enjoy any of Shark Week?
I always enjoy Shark Week. I'm not as enthusiastic about it as Nicole is, but I've seen. I also have my scuba diving license, and I've dove with great whites in Africa, and I've seen every shark in open water except for a hammerhead, pretty much. Every major shark in open water except for a hammerhead.
Well, I want to thank you.
I have no problem with them whatsoever. I put my hands on them. I've moved them when they've gotten too close to me, when I'm on dives and stuff, and a big feed in Australia that was 20 or 30 sharks ripping apart tuna heads around us, or about 25 feet away, I guess. That was a lot of fun. Had to move a couple when the feed was over. They were just cruising by a little too close for my comfort. So,
God bless you.
It's interesting.
Well, listen, that's all the show that we have. But Shane, I want to thank you for joining us by phone. Nicole, I want to thank you for coming in studio.
Absolutely, thank you.
Love to have you guys again. Maybe the next adventure, if you want to tease it, or if you've completed it, love to have you both back on. Big fans of what you've done. And maybe anything you might have on the radar for the future. We'll look forward to hearing from both of you.
Most definitely.
All right. That's all the program we have here. Maddie Nelson, great job tonight.
Thank you. As always.
Until next week at 6:15 p.m., have a good evening.
South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. 95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com.